This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Every year, approximately 75,000 people visit North Carolina's Cape Lookout National Seashore. Until now, one of the only ways to access the barrier islands is by independently owned passenger ferry operators that shuttle visitors back and forth on skiff-type boats with outboard motors. But a new plan to consolidate those ferries down to one company may put those small ferry operators in Carteret County out of business.
Not one person out of all the hundreds of people I've spoken to about it believes it's a good thing. Most of them say, that's ridiculous. What are they thinking?
Currently, 7 ferry services are authorized to take passengers to Shackelford Banks and the Cape Lookout Lighthouse. Those ferry passenger businesses operate through commercial use authorizations and receive an annual permit from the Park Service at a cost of $250 per year. Back in 1998, the Concessions Improvement Act was passed. It directed the Park Service to use concession contracts to authorize commercial services. Steve Bishop, the owner of Island Ferry Adventures in Beaufort, said he saw the new mandate for a single ferry service coming.
They had told us ever since I got in this business 20 years ago that they were intending to put this to bid for one contract. And it's just drug on. And I think everybody thought it would never happen. And now it appears that maybe it will because they have come out with the prospectus and people have bid on it.
According to Cape Lookout National Seashore Park Superintendent Pat Kenny, officials are now in the process of reviewing bids for the contract.
We bring together an independent panel of National Park Service folks that are familiar with commercial services, and they evaluate the proposals from the bidders against a set of criteria that were laid out in what's called the prospectus, which is what went out to the potential bidders. That evaluation is winding down.
Currently, 7 passenger ferry businesses operate out of Harkers Island, Beaufort, and Morehead City. Under the new plan, a site in downtown Beaufort and Harkers Island have been selected, and construction or renovation of facilities are planned for these locations to accommodate the new ferry service. The town of Beaufort has agreed to let the park use space in the town hall, which was the post office building on Front Street, free of charge.
We are outfitting that with information. We're developing some exhibits that'll go in there so that people will get provided information prior to departure, and there'll also be space for ticket sales, things like that.
The town of Beaufort has indicated that they will provide dock facilities across the street at Graydentown Park and more than 80 parking spaces near the town hall. Crystal Coast Ferry Services co-owner Bill Downham says locating in Beaufort is a bad idea and businesses in the area will likely take a hit.
People going to Shackelford, they'll park at 8:30 in the morning and they'll leave their car there until, you know, late in the afternoon. They'll come back sandy and salty, and they're not going to want to go to a restaurant. They're going to just occupy a parking space in downtown Beaufort all day long that could be used by many, many people.
In addition to the downtown Beaufort launch point, improvements will also be made to the Harkers Island Visitor Center to help handle the ferry service, including a new ticket booth, dock replacements, and the construction of a shade shelter so visitors can comfortably wait for the ferry. Havelock resident Ken Tominski works part-time with a ferry service company, and he's asked us not to use the name of the business. He says he's concerned that the added infrastructure could mean extra expenses for taxpayers.
The Park Service just needed $3.3 million to fix up the damage that Sandy did. So in the future, if their new ferry docks get damaged, guess who's going to pay for the repair of them? We are, as taxpayers.
The Park Service's plan for a single ferry company has met considerable opposition from residents and business owners in Carteret County. But Park Superintendent Kenny says they're following the law. He thinks that a contracted ferry service will provide the park's visitors with a more reliable, safe mode of transportation.
Many of these properties that these ferries operate from are private properties. There's no guarantee that ferry services would stay on them. By moving ferry services to the Harkers Island Visitor Center, and into a partnership with the town of Beaufort, we have long-term commitments to use that site, as well as long-term commitment, obviously, to use the site here in Harkers Island to create departure spots to the national park.
Of the ferry service companies we spoke with, all of them said that they already provide the safe, reliable transportation that the Park Service wants to offer. Bill Downham, the owner and operator of Crystal Coast Ferry Services in Morehead City, commented on a statement made by Park Superintendent Pat Kinney.
The reason they're doing this, they're making this change, is to provide a more reliable ferry service for the traveling public. And I couldn't even sleep that night after I heard him say that. I've been sitting on this corner where we operate from for 2 years. The only time that I'm not here and available is when there's inclement weather where it's not safe to carry people over there. And the only time we don't run is when there's nobody to run over there.
Safety concerns are just one of the reasons for the new ferry concession. According to Superintendent Kinney, the change will allow the Park Service to get information about Cape Lookout National Seashore to people prior to visiting the park.
You know, we can provide them information about the park, what's required, what they will need once they're out there, what services are there or not there. So it's an opportunity to kind of create a gateway as you leave, before you leave, and provide information to the visitors.
Prior to the bid process, public meetings were held to hear concerns from residents and business owners. Kinney says they also studied the economic impact on local businesses and ferry operators and determined that it would be a fiscally sound operation. But when asked about the independently owned passenger ferry business that would cease to operate without the contract, he said,
"That's the hard part of this was that, you know, obviously there's impacts to this proposal to the businesses. The winning bidder will have the rights to the point-to-point transportation from the mainland, from Harkers Island and the Beaufort, to the park. The existing other ferry services will not be allowed to provide that point-to-point transportation."
While Superintendent Kinney maintains the effects of the proposal will be minimal, Havelock resident Ken Taminski believes it will be widespread.
They're going to go to one operator with four boats and two skiffs. There has to be some amount of job cuts, not to mention administrative staff. Additionally, we use local marine service companies to service our boats. We also patronize the local merchants in Beaufort, as do the other ferry operators. Additionally, I mean, these guys are involved in the community so much so that, you know, some of them make donations to the Maritime Museum, to other organizations. I don't know how the man can say there's not going to be economic impact.
The request for bids went out earlier this year, and they closed at the end of June. It was recently announced that only two bids were submitted. When asked why they only had two bids for the contract, Park Superintendent Kinney said,
I don't know. I anticipated more than that.
Steve Bishop, the owner of Island Ferry Adventures, which has been operating out of Beaufort for 12 years, said he was interested in bidding. But when he began to crunch the numbers, he says things didn't add up.
I went carefully over the prospectus. I hired a company that helps you write contracts to win government bids. And the more I got into it, I realized that it would not work the way they want to do it.
As part of the contract, the Park Service will receive a minimum of 9% of revenue from the gross percentage of the business that wins the bid. The prospectus also requires that ferry operators purchase a specific type of boat that holds up to 35 passengers and requires businesses to have $1.5 million in backing.
The Park Service wants 9% of the gross. So assuming you do $1 million the first year, then they're going to get 90. And to put $90,000 on the bottom line for whoever operates it, I have figured that you have to get $21 per passenger. Well, in Harkers Island right now, they've got ferry services carrying you out there for $10. So are we going to go up 110% on those?
The prospectus also mentions that the ferry operator will charge their standard $10 to $15 rate for the first year. After, the Park Service will consider allowing the business to increase the fare per passenger. As park officials finish reviewing bids, the next step includes a legal review to ensure that there's sufficient justification for the decision. If they approve it, the winning bidder may be notified as early as September. The goal, Kinney says, is to have the ferry operational by April 2014. If the contract is awarded, Bill Downham of Crystal Coast Ferry Services says they'll have to sell one of their boats and consider providing local cruises to keep their business afloat.
And if that doesn't work, we'll have to sell that boat, and we're out.
Ferrying passengers to Shackelford is big business, making up about 80% of the profit Crystal Coast Ferry Services receives. Likewise, the owner of Island Ferry Adventures, Steve Bishop, says his company will probably focus on giving tours. Bishop also runs Lookout Cruises, a 42-passenger sailing catamaran in Beaufort.
So I don't know whether it would, I doubt seriously it would be profitable by just doing the tours and the few smaller island ferry service that we do. But it's something that I'll look at, and if I can make a little bit of money and keep these people working, then I'd certainly be interested in doing it.
Although specific details aren't known at this time, Cape Lookout National Seashore Park Superintendent Pat Kenny says they are looking at the possibility of offering contracts to companies who want to open up tour businesses where owners would provide guided tours of the area for a fee. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. Last Saturday, August 3rd, marked the 284th anniversary of the birth of Richard Caswell, North Carolina's first and fifth governor, serving from 1777 to 1780 during the Revolutionary War, and again from 1785 until 1788. The Caswell Memorial in Kinston will belatedly acknowledge his birthday Saturday the 10th, with activities celebrating his life and accomplishments during a second Saturday event. Free activities occurring at state historic sites and museums across the state. Caswell was born in Maryland in 1729 and died in Fayetteville in 1789. What occurred after that prompted a mystery that remains unsolved until about 3 years ago. George Olson has this, which originally aired in July 2010.
Richard Caswell was the state's first constitutional governor and an important figure in state Revolutionary War history. He also established the town of Kingston, now Kinston, in 1762. Richard Caswell is an important part of North Carolina history, which makes it all the odder that at some point he got misplaced.
He dies in Fayetteville. They have a state funeral for him. And then the last thing you hear or read in the Fayetteville Observer is he's on a cart being sent out to Kinston. But there's nothing about him arriving in Kinston. There's nothing about him being buried in Kinston. The documentary record of that time period is just completely mute on that particular topic, and that's what adds to the mystery.
Dr. Charles Ewan, a professor of anthropology at East Carolina University, 221 years after his death in 1789, no one is sure where Caswell is buried until now, sort of.
To my way of thinking, we've found the grave and all that's left of him there.
Dr. Ewan has been on an off-and-on search for Caswell's grave for around 10 years. To say the grave is lost is a bit of a misnomer. While some have suggested he was buried in Fayetteville where he died, most of the historical record indicates he was buried at one of two Kinston locations. His will even mentions his wish to be buried in Kinston, though, again, adding to the mystery, the will mentions two different burial sites. Ewan and his archaeology students have conducted excavations over that 10-year period, trying to determine where Caswell is buried. The most recent was in 2008, following the discovery of a photo by the North Carolina Museum of History indicating the location of Caswell's grave between that of his two wives and daughter. That site, conveniently, at the CSS Noose and Governor Caswell Memorial State Historic Site in Kinston.
So we followed up on that. We did some radar work, found where a grave was located, scraped off the top, found the grave pit, excavated that. And, you know, it's just one of these mysteries that keep going. We got to the bottom of the grave and found the bottom of a coffin, and that was it.
There was no skeleton, no buried mementos, nothing. In some ways, though, finding nothing was correct. For instance, Caswell was a Masonic Grand Master, which led Ewan to wonder why Caswell wasn't buried with Masonic regalia.
The Masons that I spoke to, they told me the only thing he would have been buried with would have been a leather apron, and that any rings or medallions and stuff would have been passed on to his children. So the fact that we didn't find any Masonic regalia apparently was not something that was unexpected.
But in fact, something was left behind, though it took chemical analysis of soil samples taken during the excavation to find it.
When a body decays and it's in a dark, cool, damp area, the fats start to render into a soapy substance. In fact, it is a soap, and it's called grave wax or adipocere. If you have the opportunity to have the body actually change into this adipocere, this grave wax, then some of that can be stable and left in the soils. And in fact, we found it in the dark soil above the bottom of the coffin and below the coffin, where I think some of the stuff, the grave wax and the body liquor, kind of leak down into the area underneath the coffin.
During excavation, water had to be pumped from the grave pit, so it's Ewan's theory that the water table rose and lowered again and again, with the coffin and its contents soaked and then drying repeatedly over a couple hundred years, that ultimately everything but the coffin bottom, somewhat preserved because it stayed consistently inside the water table, decayed into nothing.
Long story short, I think we found where Richard Caswell was buried, and he's just nothing left of him now.
One other thing to indicate this is, in fact, Governor Caswell's grave. It's marked, though as with so much of the mystery, it's marked sort of. There was never any indication that Caswell's grave received a proper headstone. The only historical mention of anything marking his grave was an oak tree growing at its head. And yet, about 100 years ago, something was placed at the site that Charles Ewan believes is the final resting place of North Carolina's first governor.
Interestingly enough, there was a monument put downtown in Kinston during the 19th century. It was an obelisk type of thing. And then when there was a fire in downtown Kinston, the obelisk was damaged, and it was an obelisk to Caswell. And so they moved it to this cemetery. Well, I think it's pretty coincidental, or it's more than coincidental, that where they put the base of this monument is right at Caswell's grave. So that kind of leads me to wonder, well, was he really lost, or did people at that time generally know, yeah, that's where he was, and that's where we'll put the monument?
So Dr. Ewan's search is concluded. However, he adds, if someone comes up with compelling evidence disputing his belief,
well, then maybe we'll look. You never say never.
Dr. Charles Ewan is a professor of anthropology at East Carolina University. The Governor Caswell Memorial, and apparently the governor's grave, is located on West Vernon Avenue in Kinston. I'm George Olson.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Vidant Health, proud to open the James and Connie Maynard's Children's Hospital at Vidant Medical Center, offering more medical specialties, including neonatal and pediatric intensive care, cancer and kidney care, surgery, and much more. Online at vidanthealth.com/children.
Hi, this is Tom the Jazz Man inviting you to join me this Sunday evening right here on PRE, Public Radio East, on all five frequencies as we explore the great sounds of America's music, jazz. It was made in America and now it's enjoyed around the world, and musicians all over the world are embracing this wonderful art form. Join us on Sunday evening right here on Public Radio East.
Entertaining and informational. That's a hallmark of Public Radio East's commitment to you. Programs like Fresh Air, This American Life, Science Friday, Here and Now, and The Splendid Table engage you while widening your intellectual horizons. You help make it happen. Consider increasing your support today by joining Public Radio East's Barker Leadership Circle at publicradioeast.org.
The Siler City-based bluegrass quintet New Blue is receiving national accolades with their newly released third CD, 10, achieving top 10 bluegrass sales status in the August 3rd edition of Billboard magazine. 10 marks their 10th year as a performing unit, remarkable in that the band nearly dissolved as soon as it formed. George Olson spoke with the group's founder on the release of their debut CD, Nights, back in 2010, and has this, which originally aired in August of that year.
The Siler City-based New Blue was initially formed in the fall of 2003, and that's where the story almost ended. On Thanksgiving weekend, shortly after the quartet came together, one of the band's two founders, Carolyn Ruth, suffered not one but two strokes that initially left her without speech and the use of her right side. With a push from then-bandmate and friend and now bandmate and husband Daniel Ruth, she made it all the way back.
Thank the Lord that her speech came back very quickly. But it became one of those things of, you know, before it was, we're going to do this because this is what we want to do when we're all musicians and things like that. And then it became an even greater need to continue on with New Blue. And
it was therapeutic, really.
It was. There was a lot of therapy involved. And music's good therapy anyway. So, you know, if you can combine that with therapy that you have to do, it just works.
It was a common goal.
You can hear evidence of Carolyn Ruth's complete recovery with the recent release of the band's first CD release, Nights.
Can't go out, I can't stay.
disc is a nice mix of traditional and contemporary bluegrass sounds, leaning a bit toward the traditional, but fans of so-called newgrass artists like Alison Krauss will almost certainly find the disc to their liking. That could come from the Roos' eclectic background. Carolyn started singing in church, did musicals in high school, loves the music of Pat Benatar, sang contemporary Christian music, and performed rock before forming New Blue. Daniel is a banjo player turned rock band bassist in the same band as Carolyn, turned guitar player in New Blue, who says he's as likely to be listening to Van Halen as Flat and Scruggs.
Just about anything that we can come up with, we usually find a way to make it fit. Let's try to do this song. Let's bring this new song in from whatever genre, and let's see how it works. And then we end up molding it and working it around to where it comes out sounding like, you know, something totally different, and it sounds good, and everybody's like, oh, this is this great new sound. And we're like, well, thanks. We like it, but it's really just what comes out of trial and error.
Well, the Blue Ridge Mountains at the fall of the night, it sure feels good when you cross that.
That trial and error method of moving songs from outside the bluegrass genre isn't too much in evidence on Nights. There's one tune co-written by 80s country pop singer Juice Newton, and another from the contemporary folk genre by Nancy Griffith, but otherwise everything fits very comfortably under the bluegrass tag. Comfortable also describes how the Roos feel about their decision to leave their rock band days behind.
When we ended up stopping playing rock and roll, we just kind of let the rock and roll band go, because we both decided as much as we loved the rock, we loved the music, but some of the venues that were available and just the whole persona, we weren't comfortable necessarily in our own skins always doing that. And bluegrass being a music that we already loved, and being more, I always looked at it at that time and even now, as a family music. You go to festivals and, you know, there's families and there's kids. It's a music that just transcends all age groups, and that's something that we both really loved about it.
One thing firmly in the bluegrass tradition on Nights, a couple of train songs. For Daniel Ruth, the train songs came before the train. He says this year he experienced his first long-distance train travel. While traveling, he thought of all the train songs he knew, but can't put his finger on what makes this mode of travel such an inspiration for songwriters.
We're lucky enough to still have a train come through our little town. And, you know, you get a sleepless night or something, and I'm bad to go out back, you know, on the back deck or something like that. And I've been outside at night at 2 o'clock in the morning when the train comes through. And it's, you know, it's dead still. There's nothing going on. And you just hear this train whistle in the distance. And it's just, there's so many emotions that just roll up in that. And I have no way to explain it.
What if I'd held you in my arms and let everything else go? Would I still be haunted by lonesome whistle?
If why trains make excellent songwriting fodder remains beyond Daniel's grasp, the inspiration for one of Knight's Daniel Ruth penned tunes is not. In fact, she's sitting right beside him.
It all sparked from, there's several Carolyn songs out there, and there's one, in fact, that Lonesome River Band did one time called Carolyn the Teenage Queen, and it was this tragic story of this, you know, she's like, why are all the Carolyn songs always bad? So I said, well, I'll write a good Carolyn song. But, yeah, the whole idea is to have a happy Carolyn song, not a sad or mean Carolyn song.
Writing a happy Carolyn song is probably a bit redundant nowadays when you consider where New Blue is now after their near tragic beginnings in 2003 following Carolyn's stroke. She describes herself and Daniel as all or nothing type personalities. Given where she started from that Thanksgiving weekend, she's gone from nothing to all and is grateful for every opportunity.
The amount of time that it took me to be able to get the use back of my sight and be able to function again was remarkably short compared to what all predictions had been. And there's no other way to explain it besides just absolutely a miracle. And yes, I do feel very blessed every time I'm able to go on stage and perform or go in the studio and record and just be out there and be able to do what I love to the extent that I'm able to do it now. Yes, you got tired of having me around. So you took your love and pain every time.
Carolyn and Daniel Ruth are the co-founders of the Siler City Bluegrass Quartet, New Blue. Their debut CD is Nights and is available on their own Red Squared label. I'm George Olson.